Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2008. My castaway this week is Shami Chakrabarty. As Director of Liberty, she has used her barrister's training to huge effect, adroitly parrying what she perceives as fundamental assaults on our civil liberties. A recent high point for her, the defeat of the government's 42-day detention bill for terror suspects. Despite her diminutive stature and relative youth, she is still in her 30s, she regularly slugs it out in the media with political bruisers and has been voted one of our most inspiring political figures. Her inspiration? To Kill a Mockingbird. It's about walking around in other people's shoes, she says. Atticus Finch is just the perfect human rights hero. Shami Chakrabarty, you started working at Liberty then. It was on the 10th of September 2001, and that was the day before 9/11, the events that have done probably more than anything else to shape the debate that we are currently in the middle of about our human rights. Do you remember what you were doing on that actual day of 9/11?
I certainly do. As you said, it was my second day at Liberty. I had a new job. I was meeting colleagues and chatting about what the future might hold for a campaign group like Liberty, what the priorities should be. I had lunch with a new colleague, and when I returned, we saw the pictures appearing on people's computer screens and on the television. And it was, of course, completely horrific. I don't think I quite knew at the time, but I was also pregnant. And in the weeks and months that followed, I thought, you've just left the Home Office. Is this the time to be leaving all your chums in the Home Office who are trying to keep people safe? And is this the time to be bringing a new life into the world?
I mean, so many issues, of course, have flowed from 9/11, and people have talked exhaustively about them, and maybe we'll get into some of them in some detail a little later on. But I'm wondering if you remember how early on at Liberty you began to understand that there would be an enormous shift in the work that you did.
What I didn't realise initially was just how fundamental the shift would be. I never imagined Guantanamo Bay. I never even imagined that we would depart from very old concepts of charging people and trying them before we punish them in Britain.
And as you say, this period of intense professional activity was to coincide with you being pregnant and giving birth. I'm wondering how much of a link there was between the professional and the private there, the birth of your child. Did that also add to the mix of motivation?
It's very hard to separate these things. Becoming a parent had a profound effect on me, I think, in two ways. Firstly, I don't think I would ever have been crazy enough to apply to be Director of Liberty if I wasn't drunk on being a mother and thinking, well, that's the most amazing thing I've ever done. Surely I can do anything now. But I think the other profound change was my attitude to human rights. They weren't just legal concepts or philosophical concepts anymore. It felt like I had a huge investment in the future, a personal, emotional investment. But hopefully also I understood more what it is to be afraid, what it is to really worry about whether your family are going to be blown up on the underground or whether your child is safe. And I hope that that's helped the way that we try to frame some of our arguments as well.
Tell me about your first piece of music today then.
Well, this is a no-brainer for me. It's not representative, it is the song. And this is a song that my husband and I sang to our little boy when he was a baby. I wish I knew how it would feel to be free.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free.
Nina Simone and I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free, and that was a song that you used to sing to your son to get him to go to sleep, Shami. Let's talk then about your own childhood. You grew up in North London. What are your earliest memories of growing up?
My earliest memories are of my parents' house full of food and full of guests, and full of laughter and sometimes argument, sometimes heated debate. It was a very open house. They had friends who had come to London from all over the world and who they'd made friends with during their bedsit period.
So they'd come from Calcutta to Hampstead at the end of the 50s.
That's right. My parents lived in what's now obviously a very smart part of town, but in the late 50s and early 60s, when it was bedsit land, they learnt, my dad in particular, learnt to cook. But they are, because they're both around, thank goodness, dreamers and not people who were ever really interested in making a lot of money and that kind of success.
What were their dreams?
They believed in things that I now believe in, but I now have language for it. I'm now a sort of human rights campaigner. A lot of the early motivations for that probably came from them. Everyone's bored of me telling the story about my dad, telling me why the death penalty is wrong.
That was when, were you watching a TV report about the Yorkshire Ripper?
That's right, and I think I was trying to show off to my dad and that I could make some sense of this, and I said something about what they should do to that monster when they caught him. And my dad is not a classic bleeding heart liberal at all, but he turned to me very quietly. He's not generally very quiet either, but this was his one big Atticus Finch moment, I think, and he said, you've got to understand that no criminal justice system in the world will ever be absolutely perfect, and you have to imagine that you are the one person in a million, and you've been convicted, no one believes you, even your family don't really believe you anymore, and you are walking to the electric chair or to the gallows, and how does that feel? And that is my earliest profound political memory.
And you say, untypically for him, it was a quiet moment of discussion. He was a big character?
He is a big character with a big heart and on occasion a quick temper and jumping into arguments and lots of opinions, and there's a bit of that in me, I suspect.
And you say he's a great cook and your mum was a great cook too. There was lots of entertaining in that.
Lots of entertaining.
I mean, cash around to do the entertaining?
Well, no, I mean, there was never lots of cash around, but it was about their priorities, really. I mean, they really are that kind of family who would probably eat baked beans for a few days and then save up to have this wonderful dinner for all their friends. And they were like that with me too. You know, they saved up so that I could go on school trips, and they saved up for my violin lessons and allowed me all these opportunities to taste the world kind of beyond their means, really.
Let's take a break for a moment. Tell me about your second piece of music today then, Shami.
Well, this is David Bowie. The challenge here was which Bowie song to pick. I've picked this song because it reminds me of being at the LSE and going to Berlin the New Year's Eve before the wall came down, and because it's called Heroes and there have been so many heroes in my life.
David Bowie and Heroes. You mentioned that your parents saved up for some of the more important things in life, one of them being violin lessons for you. Is it true, Shami Chakrabarty, that a violin case saved your life?
Absolutely, it's true. I went off to school with my violin in a fibreglass case. Yeah. The fibreglass is important. And on a zebra crossing on the way to the bus stop, I collided with a car, or a car collided with me. And I went flying over the road, but the violin case acted like a sort of shock absorber. And the violin inside was sort of smashed up. And I was barely hurt, minor head injuries. So there you have it, you know, music saved my life.
What were you like as a young schoolgirl? I mean, if you encountered your schoolgirl self now, how would you describe her?
I think I was precocious, probably a little irritating, probably took myself a little too seriously. You see, some people hear this and say, nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. Quite intense, certainly until my sort of late teens.
And you went to state school. Were you one of the brightest in your class?
I was, brightest. Whether I was one of the brightest or not, I was a SWAT.
Were you top of the class?
I guess, yeah. And I was a SWAT and I beavered away and I thought I could do anything. And that thinking you could do anything came from my mum and dad, no question.
And your individual experience, the mid to late 70s, early 80s, a time of skinheads and bover boys, and did you encounter any of that?
I had a very fortunate childhood, and I won't say that I experienced anything like some of the racism that so many people have experienced, but you couldn't be untouched by it. I knew, for example, that my parents had been subject to a racist attack.
This is a physical attack?
A physical attack. You know, my mum and dad were attacked by a group of skinheads, you know, when I was just a few months old. And there were times in the 70s when I felt uncomfortable. I can remember sitting on the tube with my parents and feeling uncomfortable by, you know, a group of fellow passengers, possibly, football fans singing slightly racist chants. You know, I was never terrified, and it never went on for very long, but I can remember hoping that my parents hadn't noticed. Parents haven't noticed that piece of graffiti, those slightly menacing people at the end of the carriage, and of course they're feeling the same way about me.
Of course. Tell me about your next piece of music then.
This piece of music, beautiful piece of music, has probably haunted me for over 25 years. Since I heard it in a film called Sophie's Choice, in which Meryl Streep gives a masterpiece performance playing a Holocaust survivor in the United States just after World War II. It is a haunting piece of music, and of course, you know, the story that it tells and the Holocaust and the Blitz and all that become the moment from which we build modern human rights.
Daniel Barenboim playing Von Fremden Ländern und Menschen from Schumann's Scenes of Childhood, and chosen not just because you love it as a piece of music, but because it brings back memories of one of your other great loves, which is the movies that was used in Sophie's Choice. We don't know this side of you at all, because of course we see you on television so often. We see this sort of public campaigning person who is always very earnest and serious, but you have this hidden love, which is a love of the movies. When and how did it begin?
I'm sure that my love of the movies began with my mother. I can remember being really very small and sitting at home during wet school holidays, sitting snuggled up with my mother, watching Hollywood classics. And it's just never stopped for me. The cinema has just been an unending source of learning and entertainment and at times solace for me throughout my life. I'm really delighted to say that my son feels the same way, and I took him before he was 18 months old to see some cartoon or other, and he held a tortilla chip between thumb and forefinger as the lights went down and the movie started, and 2 hours later he was still holding it.
Good sign. And did you had a plan at one point to go and work in Hollywood. You thought that maybe where your future lay.
You're so cruel to expose these, you know...
It's only because you've been a big success at something else.
These unfulfilled pipe dreams that some of us have. I had this idea that maybe I wouldn't be a lawyer after all, that I could go to the States and study screenwriting. And the grand plan was to finish university, perhaps go and make some money in the city for a few years as a trader or something. You know, and I probably had no idea what that would really be like. I probably thought it was Wall Street or something. And then I'd save the money to go to the States. But there was a recession and I wasn't very good at adding up. And I was competing with all these kids with their sort of maths degrees. And
did you go for job interviews?
I can remember going to the Chase Manhattan Bank and to various other sort of city banks. And, you know, I could talk a good interview, but when it came to the mental arithmetic, I was way behind.
And what about as a student then? As you say, you're at the LSE studying law. Were you into student politics? Were you part of the student union?
I have to say, I was not into student politics at all.
Why not?
It was partly that there were all these, mostly chaps actually, but all these guys who you could just tell wanted to go and run a small country, and this was just a kind of nursery slope for them. There was also, I can remember, it was the first Iraq war, and I remember people passing lots of resolutions about that, which was fair enough, but no one was doing anything about disabled access on campus. And I thought, hang on a minute, there's a mismatch between the grand ambition and what you might be doing, which is actually delivering something closer to home.
But given you're the person that you are, why did you not decide to roll up your sleeves, get in there and change that and have those debates that were important?
I don't know. Maybe I was too busy going to the movies or maybe I was running away from my destiny as an angry campaigner.
Tell me about your next piece of music then.
I have always had this kind of love affair with the United States. And I can remember watching a movie with my dad and seeing the end credits. It's an American movie. And he said to me, look, there's a Japanese surname, there's an Italian surname, there's an Irish surname, but they're all Americans. And my parents saved up for me to finally go to the States for my 21st birthday. And it was a lot of money. You know, they saved up something like £1,000. And I turned up for the first time at Grand Central Station with my Sony Walkman. I probably shouldn't say that on the BBC, but they probably don't exist anymore, and turned on Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue as I looked up at those skyscrapers for the first time. And of course, you know, you think of Woody Allen's Manhattan, Chapter One. He loved New York City. He idolised it out of all proportion. And I've loved it ever since.
The opening of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, and memories of every Woody Allen movie you've ever seen, and standing there in Grand Central Station with that on the headphones. So, Shami Chakrabarti, you graduated in law from the LSE, and once you'd graduated, you met your husband at the bar, but it wasn't in a wig and gown. You were pulling pints at that particular bar.
Well, I was clearly pulling more than pints. That's right. The pipe dream of going to study film hadn't really worked out, and there I was kind of working out what to do next. And yes, he walked in and I eventually asked him out.
Did you have to work up the nerve?
I did have to work up the nerve, because I'd never actually, this makes me sound pathetic, but I'd never actually asked a guy out before. And I haven't done it since either, so it worked out quite well. 100% record.
Was it an instant attraction?
It was, yeah. It really was.
Have you not given him an earful about why he didn't ask you out?
Oh, for years. Have I not given him an earful? Do you know who you're talking to? Yes, an endless argument and banter for at least, I don't know, the first 7 years of our relationship.
And then, so the Home Office, it doesn't seem like an obvious fit, not quite a hand in glove, because you were an idealist, you were somebody who had, if not a sort of frontline political view, you had a political point of view. To go and work at the Home Office, where you have to be apolitical and do as your masters tell you, doesn't seem necessarily to have an obvious attraction for someone like you.
Oh, I was an idealist, but I did and still do believe that the law is, for the most part, a good thing, and that everybody behaves slightly better for good legal advice. And also, it was just going to be such a fascinating place to see law, policy and politics all coming together. And that was, you know, that was the motivation.
But really, did you ever find yourself, the inner Shami, in conflict with what you were being asked to do? Because it would have been Michael Howard, first of all, would have been your Home Secretary.
Mr. Howard, then
and
Mr.
then
Straw,
Jack Straw.
And then 5 minutes of Mr. Blunkett before I went, but not for that reason. I said to myself right at the beginning, when I started, that everybody has a line that they won't cross. And the line that I set for myself was that if there was any talk of reinstating the death penalty, then that would be it for me. There's no way that I could work in that system. That was the line, and maybe other lines would have happened. I don't know if I'd still been there. Interesting question to myself. If I'd still been there after 9/11, would I have sat there drafting laws that allowed people to be punished without trial or incarcerated without trial? I don't know. I hope not. But at the time, you know, I did raise a few eyebrows, not least in the family. I think my parents thought I was about to go and stand at the port and ask people the reason for their visit, you know.
Tell me about your next piece of music today, then.
Well, this is really for my extraordinary colleagues at Liberty, you know, and some of them 15 or more years younger than me, but so wise and so professional and so able to make a difference. And this is the Kaiser Chiefs, the angry mob, and it's witty and it's ironic, but the chorus reminds me that you don't have to be cynical, you don't have to assume that public opinion can only be followed and never be persuaded or led.
Kaiser Chiefs and the Angry Mob. And you said there, Shami Chakrabarty, that you were dedicating that song to many of your colleagues at Liberty. You came to Liberty as a lawyer, and then, as you said, you propelled yourself to the front line. And you know, being a mother, you felt suddenly empowered to onto greater things. And your objective was to raise the profile of human rights issues, which were passionate and dear to you, and to make it a front-line discussion.
Yeah, I would say that I thought that we had been sounding like a bunch of lawyers, which is fine for the courtroom, but it was really important to get our values out into the newsroom and the classroom and the parliament chamber. I thought, and I still think, actually, that we're very fortunate to live in, I know, probably the oldest unbroken democracy on earth. And, you know, we can get a bit cynical about politics and about the possibilities of social change. But I have seen it. You can bring a coalition of people together and you can make good things happen.
You seemed instantly to be comfortable with a very high public profile. You seemed to be everywhere all the time and happy to give comments and happy to sit there on whatever it be, the question time panels. And, you know, these are very demanding public forums. You enjoy that?
Some of them are actually terrifying, the truth be told. I think, you know, it would just be a lie to say that your stomach doesn't turn when you hear that question time music. So yes, there are aspects that are terrifying. But the bottom line is, if I didn't do this job, I'd be sitting in the pub complaining about Belmarsh and Guantanamo and 42 days and all the rest of it with a drink in my hand. You know, I get to do it with a microphone in my hand. And yes, sometimes that feels like a burden, but mostly it's just an enormous privilege.
And inevitably, of course, when you have a high profile and when you're espousing an often unpopular or unpopulist point of view, you come in for flack. There was a columnist in The Sun, John Gaunt, who said you were, I'm quoting here, the most dangerous woman in Britain. What did you make of that comment at the time?
Well, I mean, Mr. Gaunt, or Gaunty, as he likes to be known, did me a huge favour with that one. Let's face it. I just wish I were the most dangerous woman in Britain. Britain would be a lot safer place, you know.
Do you worry about your own safety?
No, I don't worry about my... What, you mean whether I'm on somebody's hit list? No.
Well, I mean, I wasn't particularly wanting to be as specific as that, but there you are, putting across a point of view which, as I've just illustrated in the popular press, can often be represented as, this woman defends terrorists, you know, she'd have them walking onto our tube trains with half a pound of Semtex strapped on their back without a second thought for the safety of our children. And that sort of argument is the sort of thing that could incite a particular sort of attention towards you.
You do get a little nasty mail. Most of it, nothing much to worry about. Occasionally something to worry about, and, you know, and then you do something about it. But I will say this, when you're stopped in the street by people, they always have something kind and nice to say. But I have had more kindness and solidarity than I've ever had of the bad stuff.
And what about for your family? Do you ever worry about putting them in the spotlight?
I'm careful about my son, who I'm describing as my son and not by name, for example. And that is a conscious decision. That's not just for safety. That's kids have to be their own person. Of course, we all care about our family and want them to be safe. That's partly what this debate is all about.
Tell me about your next piece of music, then.
Well, this is a fantastic band called The Enemy, and they are sort of 20-odd, so now they're, 20 years younger than me. Their music is contemporary, and it's passionate, and it's angry in a really positive way, but it also, for me, conjures up so many of the sounds and rhythms of my youth. You hear the Jam, the Clash, a bit of Blur, it goes on and on, and what they produce, I think, is as good as any of those greats. Stop living your life.
The Enemy, and It's Not Okay. Shami Chakrabarti, it strikes me that you find yourself, although you have been a huge hit as the leader of Liberty and you have a high public profile and people want to hear what you've got to say and people enjoy the way you articulate it very vigorously and passionately, you are in that position at a time when both main political parties want to out-tough each other. They want to prove to the public that they will keep them safe and that they're serious about running the terrorists to ground. So in a sense, you are caught in a very unfulfilling position right now.
Gosh, that's a depressing way of putting it. I ultimately feel positive about the prospects for protecting rights and freedoms in this country. Yes, I do think that for the last 15 or 20 years, there's been this authoritarian duel, if you like, between the two main parties. However, I do think that we're at a place now where we can have a conversation about what it means to be tough on crime and terrorism. It's not just about passing repressive laws. Sometimes they're counterproductive. Actually, if we go back to the core values of democracy, we could end up with policies that are actually capable of making us safe and free.
But broadly, the public does not agree with you. Broadly, the public does want CCTV. It does want identity cards. It wants to feel safe in the airport and doesn't mind taking off its shoes and having its hand luggage searched four times. It really doesn't mind doing all those things if it makes for a safer UK.
Well, that's a sweeping list of things. I think with some of these measures, like cameras, for example, it's not about having them or not having them. It's about proportionality. And when people start thinking of the financial cost of various measures like identity cards, they become very good at doing a cost-benefit analysis. It's my job to throw in concerns for your privacy and your dignity into the same, is it worth the money kind of balancing exercise. When I engage with the public, my colleagues do, when we do polling, when we test our arguments, we feel that our values run very deep in this country. Whether you agree with us or not on every particular issue, you'd miss us if we weren't there. And actually, I think that Britain cares more about its rights and freedoms than you might think.
You, of course, are very earnest in your work. Inevitably, you have to be. You're talking about very, very serious subjects. But I once read you say, "I'm not a vegetarian, I just look like one," which I thought was very funny indeed.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Are you aware that people perceive you as being this rather sensibly shod, earnest young woman?
Well, it's partly true, isn't it? We are complicated creatures, and there must be a bit of kind of the Grim Reaper in me. I am actually wearing sensible shoes as we speak, so I can't really argue with that. But when you're on the telly for 10 seconds talking about extraordinary rendition, kidnap and torture, it's not very funny. And you have a job to do, but I hope I'm a reasonably rounded person, and I try to be. I'm very happy with how things turned out. I don't feel that I should have been something else, or that there are lots of unfulfilled dreams. I'm a very, very fortunate and happy person.
Tell me about your next piece of music then.
Well, here we go. Sensible Shoes out of the window. All intellectual and musical pretensions are gone.
Because pair of red high heels for this one.
You finally got me, Kirsty. You know, soul laid bare. This is the song that we had at our wedding as our first song. And this is a lovely, sentimental piece of synthesizer music from Cyndi Lauper. It's Time After Time.
The second hand unwind. If you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Time after time. If you fall, I will catch you, I'll be waiting. Time after time. If you fall, I will catch you, I'll be waiting. Time after time.
Cyndi Lauper and Time After Time. I'm worried about you on this island. I'm worried about the cooking particularly, because you once said of your husband Martin, he not only brings home the bacon, he cooks it too. So you're not somebody that we would naturally find over the fire or at the stove.
Well, I think we've got more fundamental problems than that on the island, if I may say so, Kirsty.
Okay.
I've never even been someone who enjoyed camping, so anything, the great outdoorsy part is going to be very difficult.
Right.
And I think I will be lonely. I think ultimately, though I've mellowed a bit with the years, I still verge towards the extrovert, and it'll be strange to be without other people.
How much time do you spend on your own?
Not very much. I mean, I can be alone, and it's often a treat and a joy when you're very busy and there are lots of demands on your time. But I think it would be, it's all right for a holiday, but I don't know how I'd cope forever. I'm assuming I'm on the island forever.
Possibly, I've no idea. I'm just going to leave you there. I've no
right.
control over what happens after that.
Right. Yes, I'll be worried about how to sort of cope, find food and all the rest of it. But I think I'll be even more worried about loneliness.
And the little girl who wanted to be Prime Minister or something of the world, would the grown-up quite like to be Prime Minister or something? Do you have political ambition?
No, I don't. This was the perfect job for me. It came, in my 30s.
But surely it has a finite amount of time that
yes.
you can do it, that you can power an organisation like that through it.
Definitely.
Is a bit like leading a political party to that extent.
There's no question. You can't go on and on. And in truth, I don't know what I'd do next. I've been Director of Liberty for 5 years, the bulk of the war on terror. So, I don't know. I don't want to start a run on the pound. You've got to be careful what you say on the BBC, because suddenly people will take their money out of the bank. So I think discretion will be the better part of valour. But I'm not going to go on and on. You've got to go before people become sick of you. We don't have the money that big charities have for paid media. So as you've kind of very, politely suggested, the principal spokesperson becomes like a human logo. And occasionally that logo needs to be refreshed.
Tell me about your final choice today of the eight.
Well, to some extent, reflecting on your discs is reflecting on the gift of music. And music has been a gift to me in my life that came courtesy of my parents with those music lessons, courtesy of all the great inspirational teachers that I ever had. And this is the most exquisite piece of Mozart. It's the Requiem. I think I may feel a little melancholy on my desert island. I think I'll need a bit of solace, and I get that from this piece of music. It's complicated, like me, like all of us. It's melancholy, it's heroic, it's tragic. I think it's worthy of the island.
Thank you.
Scotus from Mozart's Requiem in D minor with the Leipzig Radio Chorus and the Dresden State Orchestra, conducted by Peter Schreier. So, Shami Chakrabarti, I'm going to give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, as you know, and I'm going to allow you one other book to take to your island. What are you going to choose?
Well, I've got a lot to read with the Bible and Shakespeare, so I'm not going to be, you know, short of volume. So I will take To Kill a Mockingbird, because it's been such an inspiration for my life, and it'll make me smile, so I'll do that.
And your luxury?
I don't suppose you're going to let me have my own little screening room so I can watch any movie that I like, are you?
Yes.
That's incredibly kind. This island is looking up. It's not quite as Spartan as I thought. That will be wonderful. Thank you very much.
I'll even give you some movies to watch.
Wonderful.
In the screening room.
Thank you very much.
And if you had to choose just one of these eight tracks, which one would it be?
I'm taking Nina. I wish I knew how it would feel to be free.
Shami Chakrabarti, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thanks, it was an honour.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.